mean, cool. So you kind of switched your focus now from being formerly lead on the Angular team to now being more involved in AI. How does your day-to-day look like?
Overall, we're figuring out how we can speed up developer productivity with AI, seeing where we can completely automate the work with AI, where it's safe to do it, and where we can just enhance the productivity slightly. Just talking to a lot of teams within the company, like Search, Gemini, YouTube, Workspace, all of them, and seeing what their goals are and figuring out how we can support them with GenAI.
Yeah. I have a question that is going through my mind a lot with like your work on improving developer productivity. How do you feel about this recent wave of layoffs in some of the companies with the official reason being optimizations for AI?
Yeah. The official reason, I have very mixed feelings. Like, first, a lot of CEOs have been over-promising how engineering will be completely, entirely automated with AI. I currently don't see
Yes.
that.
Neither
We
do
need
I.
to do a lot of work, yeah, to connect different boxes, and after that, to ensure that everything works together. And occasionally, the AI would make a mistake, actually, more often than I hoped. It will make a mistake, and we'll have to figure out what this mistake is and fix it. Like yesterday, I was working on a tool. The agent bootstrapped the first version perfectly for me, but I looked at the algorithm was like with exponential complexity. So I was thinking, do we really need to traverse these trees that way?
And that is the thing, like on a high level, it always looks correct and right, but then there still needs to be like this verification step. And I think it's a little bit morbid, but like also all these companies that have announced layoffs, either the day of or the next day had like to some extent an outage where I'm like, wow, I am shocked. Who thought that could even happen? I think I've said this a couple times in different spaces, but this year is going to be super weird with like weird layoffs. We also are going to see a lot of shitty products getting the shipped to end users. I think probably by the end of the year there's going to be a little bit of a recovery from that phase where people start, and with people I mean more like higher up C-level people being realized like, yes, it's a great tool, yes, we should use it, but there are limitations.
Yeah, I'm thinking very similarly. One thing that worries me a little bit is we're going to keep hitting more security issues, I'm sure, in the next few months, in the next couple of years, and people will be thinking, oh yeah, AI was actually just a bubble, like nothing more. It's just overhyped, which is also not the correct attitude. So I think we're
Sure.
just going in a lot of extremes. AI is just going to change the world. It's changing the world, but AI is going to
Yes.
make developers obsolete. To AI is useless. And we're actually somewhere in the middle, so I hope we get to that point a little bit sooner rather than later.
The security aspect is something that I think is very interesting. Do you see, and it's totally cool if you can't talk about this, but do you see like this being a bigger concern for Google as like a big company, being like potentially hacked by a smarter model or something like that?
Yeah, well, luckily because of the way we're managing our source code, it's not trivial to accept a compromise dependency. And even if something like that happens, let's say the Log4j issue that happened a few years ago, like we have only a single instance of this dependency, so it will be trivial to patch all the projects and redeploy them. I'll say Google is in a good place, but like nobody is completely like ensured that nothing will happen to them. I'm sure,
Sorry.
yeah. No, I was just going to say in all the companies, developers are kind of trying to figure out what is the most optimal way to use AI by just enhancing your productivity, but also not letting it like write all your code and after that deploy it to production.
And that is exactly what I love talking about because I think we're now slowly starting with this phase of like figuring out what workflows actually make sense. We're kind of going as a industry are kind of like maturing a little bit where instead of talking, oh, model capabilities, comparison. Like if I look at the latest model releases and the benchmarks, it's completely pointless because they're like all in like the span of like 3 percentage points. There's not really a clear answer, clear winner. All of these models are really good at this point. What is more interesting is like, okay, how can I utilize a certain model or a provider or a tool integrate this in my workflow for maximum productivity, maximum quality, or other constraints that are applying to you and your company. So what is the workflow that you're enjoying with AI right now?
Yeah, well, for different, I guess there are many developer journeys that we have when we're writing code, when we're creating systems, and some of them we can almost entirely automate. Like, let's say you're building a simple design system with relatively straightforward components. You can potentially automate the development of these components almost entirely just by passing a Figma mock and generating a working component on the other side. They're pretty low risk too, especially if the framework that you're using has some guardrails to make sure you're not going to get like cross-site scripting and stuff like that. So if we have enough guardrails, that's perfect. For other more sensitive systems, things would be different. We can use the AI as like a autocomplete on steroids in a way, but after that we'll have to review very carefully every single line of code. We have to do that for a design system too. I'm sure it can get us into an infinite loop or something that would crash the browser, but just different levels of rigorousness.
Okay. Couple of questions on that. So based on your answer, I assume you don't fall into this category of saying, okay, I cannot generate so much code that reviewing code isn't possible at this point anymore.
Yeah, that's something that you'd see that on Twitter all the time. This guy from Y Combinator was shipping so much and being so proud of himself. And someone hacked him, I think, a couple of hours later just because I'm staying away from Twitter these days.
fair. I think this attitude of like, okay, we want to ship so much code is definitely reasonable if you're working on like internal tools, prototypes. But if we're like talking about like a professional grade software product with actual users, actual real world constraints, either financial incentives or whatever, I don't see this a possibility with the current quality that we're dealing with.
Yeah. I see, like, for example, if you can have agents who are constantly looking at your issue tracker or like your source code and trying to figure out opportunities to improve it and open pull requests after that you can later review. This seems reasonable, still needs to be within some like reasonable boundaries too, because you can't get also like 1,000 pull requests. You just will not be able to, it's not just humanly possible to review them and make sure that the code that you're getting in would be the right implementation. But there are definitely a lot of opportunities, and a big part of the problem is just figuring out what is the right level of autonomy and what are the right guardrails.
Guardrails is an interesting point, because you recently developed and published a tool called SkillGrade that I wanted to talk to you about. So to sum up my understanding for people who might not know about SkillGrade, it's basically a testing framework for skills. So skills that are automatically provided to an agent to make sure that the usage of that skill yields the result that you expect in like a way that normal LLM evaluations work. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, pretty much. We want to make sure we evaluate our skills over time, and they're actually helpful. Like asking the agent to accomplish a task without the skill, it's not going to be better compared to using the skill, for instance, which sometimes happens.
Yes. How did you came up with the idea, and what were the biggest surprises for you?
Yeah, well, this has been like evals overall in such non-deterministic systems that we're dealing with. They're a must for many, many different aspects of it. Like Anthropic published a study demystifying agent skill evals, and reading this study, and also there is a paper called Skill Bench. I just combined these two ideas to build skill grades. Sometimes you'll see people asking the agent, hey, generate skills for me for using Vite, for instance. Mm-hmm. And the agent will generate skills. That's whatever you ask it to. But also, if the agent on its own can generate skills, you probably don't need the skills because the agent already knows how to use Vite.
Yes.
So this is just going to pollute your context window. Similarly, so skill grade can make sure that can allow you to test that with the skill you have better results compared to not using the skill. And additionally, the skill is just plain text, so you can keep adding text and make sure that the skill and think that the skill is actually doing better. But at the end of the day, you need some kind of an eval to make sure that the changes that you're making are positive and your skill is not regressing by them. So with SkillGrade, you can... Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, with SkillGrade, you can just have something like a CI in which when the model changes or when your agent changes or when the skill changes, you run the evals and see whether you get better or worse scores.
Do you also then run comparison with the same skill between different models? Is that something that where you notice the difference?
Yeah, different models, different agents, all the variables can just...
Interesting.
Make it or break it, yeah.
So another thing that I saw, I think right now, one of the things that it does support ACP, the agent client protocol, right?
Yeah, someone opened a pull request with this.
That I thought that was a really cool idea to support as many different agents as possible to make it kind of work out of the box with like various aspects. But tell me a little bit about that experience of like comparing the same skill with different agents and models. Like, is that really something where you ultimately come to the conclusion, oh, for this skill, you, I don't know, in Claude Code, you might want to use it. In Codex, you realistically don't need that. And do you have like an example like that?
Yeah, I guess usually what I would, the way I would use SkillGrade is in, if in the organization, usually organizations agree to use a particular agent. Like a lot of people are betting on Claude Code or all of, so in these cases, just I'll recommend setting up evals for with the agent that you're actually using. I'll say it's rare that I have found that one agent doesn't need the skills completely and the other does, or the model. They're trained on very similar, very large data sets, so they're usually comparable. But sometimes some agents are better in following instructions than others.
Sure.
And everything changes also by the month, so you can't really memorize all these differences. And if you optimize for a particular model today, when they release the next version, things might be a little bit different. So it's worth revisiting. Yeah. I'm most familiar with the Gemini models.
Yes. Fair enough. Is that something that is also used inside Google now for some purposes, or is that something that you were like, had like a funny idea after reading these papers and be like, oh, I should work on that?
We do have evals.
Of course.
Yeah. And overall evals, the idea is similar and the implementation is kind of pretty identical as well overall. Yeah. You just need to test an agentic workflow and after that have graders, which evaluate whether the agent accomplished what it was supposed to accomplish. So that's how Anthropic described their skill evals, and that's what the most common implementation of skill evals are. There are differences around kind of what environment do you use to run them. Do you run them locally or in a Docker container or in a virtual machine or elsewhere? But yeah, overall, the implementations are pretty standard.
Okay. I want to kind of bridge the gap because I think you also used this tool and some other research that you do before to work on a skill for Angular with the Angular team, your former Angular team. Is there any learnings that you that surprised you to some extent where it's like, oh, I didn't expect Angular in an agentic workflow would have issues with that, that you can codify in a skill? Let's maybe start with that question.
Yeah. Also, one thing to your previous question, you asked if Google is using that. At Google, because of the very different infrastructure we have, we're using like different things. Some Google teams that are working on GitHub have been using SkillGrade, including the Angular team.
Okay, very cool. Oh yeah, very cool.
And yeah, Mark did a lot of that work. Actually, he was a really great early adopter of SkillGrade, gave me a lot of good feedback when he was trying the Angular developer skills. There are some things like we keep trying to get the model to use modern Angular syntax, for example.
Yeah.
And with skills, sometimes it does a little bit better, but you still don't have guarantees that it's going to use at if instead of NGF.
Yep.
So this maybe it was a little bit of a surprise for us at the beginning, but we've been dealing with that for like over a year or two for now. If the model has been trained on a very large data set of data, it's really hard to ask it to do something differently. Like it would, it's really hard for the model to follow instructions when it has been trained with something else.
Okay, this is probably the question that I was the most interested in once you said, like, oh yeah, I'm happy to join you for this podcast. With the things you now know about how LLMs behave, how they are used in the industry, would you have made different decisions in how you design Angular as a framework?
Angular, I think, is doing mostly well. Dealing with internal technologies, yeah, we did. We started with evals for Angular early on. Because we thought that there might be some, there were opinions at the beginning that React is going to be do better with CodeGen because the adoption is so much higher compared to Angular. So we wanted to validate whether that's actually true. We did evals for Angular, we did evals for React. We found out that the code generation is very similar. Both of them have tens of millions of files as training data. So after a certain threshold, you don't really get that big for return of investment. I'd say challenges, you could hit a lot of challenges when the technology is trying to be another technology in a different way.
I think I know where you're going, but would you mind elaborate?
I'm thinking, imagine you design a framework that looks so much like React, but has slightly different semantics.
Yes.
How do you teach the model that the semantics is slightly different? You can write so many skills, you can do wherever you want, but you're always going to have problems in your code generation workflow, and you're always going to, your model is always going to be biased towards generating React code, even though your technology is implemented differently, has different semantics.
The Angular team has done a lot of work over the last years to improve the developer experience, primarily, for instance, with things like getting rid of modules, standalone components, which kind of like pollutes the set of training data in that sense, that you have like various patterns with a different gravity, because like you will in a set of training, I mean, standalone components were introduced, what, like 3-4 years ago?
Yeah.
Whereas like everything before was kind of with modules and those kind of things. So is that something where you now know it? Obviously, like at the time when Angular 2 came around, conceptually, it wasn't quite there to be ready for those things. But is that something where, like, okay, the focus on developer experience kind of polluted the training data? Is that something that you, I don't want to say regret, because, like, obviously, focusing on the people working with these tools is a very important thing, but where you now would focus on different things?
Yeah, things would have been simpler. Yeah. Still, there are ways to during training to enforce certain best practices. So that's something that kind of model vendors also do to make sure that their models are giving optimal results. I was thinking currently with GenAI, we are kind of increasing the level of abstraction on which we are operating a little bit, and NGF versus ATF matters a little bit less.
Yes.
So at the end of the day, I mean, we've been getting also modern syntax lately, but at the end of the day, if I'm building a system quickly and there is no sufficient difference between NGF and ATF, they're mostly for easier readability by humans, it wouldn't really matter for me whether I'm generating the node or neural syntax. Mm-hmm. We're not at a place still at which we have completely abstracted this away. But we might be there a few years from now. And by then, I guess models would also pick up the latest patterns.
So now I'm curious, because that kind of opens up the conversation of like, okay, what a software engineer is doing is kind of changing. And what, I wouldn't even say what a software engineer is doing, but what is expected from a software engineer is to some extent changing. And there's this narrative going on in the industry that part of the engineering profession is being involved with product decisions. Which to some extent, I would argue that that was always a differentiating factor for like high value software engineers in our industry. But is that something or a pattern that you could see being more prominent in our industry, where what a software engineer is changing? And yeah, curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm seeing it. I watched a really good talk by the creator of the programming language IFO a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying how that's also a often like frequent comparison. You can see how people are thinking, well, we move from writing assembly codes to writing higher level languages. And there was a period of time in which we had these languages, but the compilers were not advanced yet, so we still had to deal with the assembly code and with the high-level programming languages. We were thinking that high-level programming languages are useless, because why would you need them when you still have to deal with the assembly? And at the same time, we're just leveling up our abstraction levels. So recently, we've been having to think a little bit less about memory management if we're using languages with garbage collection or scripting languages. And you still can find developers who would actually tell you, yeah, if you don't manage your memory yourself, you're not a real programmer. Well, these people are more of the minority. So yeah. I see it as similar kind of level of abstraction shift. You still need to think, what are different building blocks and how do they communicate together? And big part of the value proposition of humans right now is all this context, implicit context that they have, which could be domain expertise, as you said, the product decisions, could be also very deep understanding of engineering. A lot of people have been working in the industry for, I don't know, 20, 30 years, and they would just intuitively make good decision. I was chatting with someone at a party over the weekend, like Silicon Valley party. It was
I figured.
Erasure. He just retired recently, and I would just imagine all these changes happening, and that's the year when you retire. It's wild. He's been working in the industry for like 50 years or so. A long time, yeah. And he went through so much. He was saying how with Cursor, he's kind of guiding it in a way that he would guide an intern. And he has just so much context in his head that he would just know how things should happen. And Cursor is the one writing the code, so he doesn't have to annoy people with his mechanical keyboard as much.
That was part of what I'm wondering, if the mechanical keyboard industry is going to see like a decline and programmers not being interested in it as much anymore. But I like this metaphor of treating AI, at least in the current state, as a very eager junior developer who can write a bunch of code, is also very often surprisingly correct with a lot of the things. But there still needs to be like this oversight to some extent. Well, okay, you're missing some context here. You're missing this very critical piece of information here. So I think the way that I at least work with LLMs, therefore, is also I prefer working on like small iterations where I can like guide again instead of like doing a full-blown specification, because that is the level of control that I like, that I feel comfortable with. I am now, though, curious, based on what you said, what do you think is the single most valuable skill a software engineer should focus on right now to be prepared for whatever is coming? And no one knows what's coming, so I'm not going to come back to it here in like 2 years. You told me to focus on XYZ, and now that skill is useless. I think this is just such an interesting time where we need to, and a lot of software engineers, I see this, are struggling because a lot of their identity as engineer was around this aspect of writing code, and that is fading. I never identified myself as someone who writes fantastic code. I was always like very mediocre at that, and still am. I have more of those people skills that I can connect different departments. I can translate those things really nicely to developers who are smarter than I am. So I'm curious to hear what you think is the most valuable skill someone could focus on in the age of AI.
Yeah. Existing developers, right? Or
yes.
Juniors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Existing.
Yeah. My intuition since before I studied computer science was to focus on the foundations. Like when I was writing, like creating PHP web apps, jQuery was the big thing back then, and I was not using jQuery. I was writing everything from scratch with all the different ways to do Ajax back then. Pretty helpful. So something similar. Maybe not necessarily. I mean, it's worth looking into how the different LLMs work too, but this might be a little bit of a sidetrack that may or may not have return of investment, but figuring out how the different building pieces work and how they compose together into your agentic workflows. I think that's worth it.
I think that is interesting. And as part of the fundamentals, I would also consider like the system design aspect, where it's, I think those are skills that are going to be highly valuable. Because like, yes, I can absolutely go to Claude Code and be like, design this fancy application for me on like a system level. But realistically, there are constraints missing. There are, even if it's just like maintainability aspect, it's a very different thing if you're working on something all by yourself or in a team of 100 developers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, yeah, the level of abstraction is raising. So great point.
Because you brought up the point of like for existing developers versus people coming in the industry, would your answer be dramatically different?
It will be similar. I'm still trying to figure out how much attention we should be paying on learning like computer science fundamentals. In my opinion, in my mind, they're still very critical. Like my LLM, as I mentioned to you, like generated an exponential algorithm, which, or it will occasionally build a web app that would render with one frame a second. And I'll have to go fix it. But also on a day-to-day basis, you have to write algorithms, even like complicated computer science algorithms, even less frequently than before.
Yes.
So this way of thinking is still important. I agree with you. Architecture and system design will be more critical.
So with that conversation, would you recommend a friend, a person you met at a San Francisco party to go in the industry right now?
If they're passionate about it, yeah. I was thinking back in the day when I was starting, probably when you were starting too, people who were getting into computer science software engineering, there were people who were passionate about the problems. At some point, people started going there because they can make good money. And yeah, if you're not passionate about this, it's harder.
Yes. So the one thing that I come back to is that if I take a couple steps back, like fundamentally things are not changing as dramatically as it might seem. Like, because software development has always been an industry where you need to keep up, you need to learn new tools, you need to get familiar with new workflows. This, we have always done that. Like the Angular 2 phase was such a great time because like there came like a new web framework every single week and you kind of wanted to play with them. You needed that level of curiosity. Software engineering for me was never a stable industry in the sense that like you learn something and then you do this for 30 years. I've not met with a few, I actually have met a couple of engineers who worked for 30 years at the same company, started doing COBOL and are retiring, still doing COBOL. So it's not quite true, but like for the vast majority of software engineers, that's not true. I started my career with Ruby on Rails. I haven't written Ruby on Rails in years. Do I still have huge respect and did I learn a lot of stuff? And it's a lot of the stuff that I'm excited about, very much inspired by the language design of Ruby. Absolutely. But that's also very much how I like to look at AI. Yes, we absolutely are in this period right now of change where like workflows are changing, the tools we're using are changing. But that is such a important characteristic of our industry that like we need to like separate a little, because the ratio of noise to signal is completely off the charts. So your argument of I'm not on Twitter right now, I completely get. But that's one of the things that is pretty important to me. I would still recommend people that where I see they have this drive where like, yes, you constantly need to learn if you're going in the industry. So I would still recommend people to go into software engineering. Would my argument, well, it's a casual job and very stable and you get a nice income. I cannot say this right now. I don't feel like super confident in making those claims. Is it an interesting field? Is it exciting? Is there a lot to learn? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. If they're passionate, they should go for it.
Yes. This brings up a little bit, though, the question of like, okay, how do we learn? Because like, and this is kind of what I'm struggling with, because I very much learned by pain very actively. Like, one of the big pains I had was System.js and Angular 2 beta things. I still have no idea about System.js, so the pain was not quite big enough for me to learn it. But I'm wondering if that is a thing where we as an industry need to recalibrate, because I know for a fact a lot of people learn by struggle. That is how I got in the RxJS core team. I never understood it. I was like, okay, Angular is so centered around RxJS. I need to understand this. So I started contributing. And I'm wondering, with AI, this pain is going to fade a little bit. If something is painful, we're just going the path of least resistance, which is going to be AI figure this out. Do you, in your role as like helping teams being productive with engineers, have you found patterns that work better in that particular situation?
I was thinking what you mentioned also with how you were learning, like through painful experiences, you hit issues with System.js, so you dug into and tried to figure it out. Another way of learning, I guess, you could be using the technologies as a user, and that's fine. You'll be able to ship very fast. Depends also on your interests. If your interests are to ship really fast, then you don't necessarily need to understand the technology from the inside too. I've been having interest into, like, I started using Angular and I was curious how it works. So I started digging into it, learned about a lot of different things from there. So that's one way to, I guess my way to learn things. Now I was interested in agentic workflow, so started building agentic workflow support different teams at Google. And it's a good way. And also AI is so helpful to help me learn new things. I've been using it for guitar.
Oh, shit. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
talk me through that process. Like, how do you learn guitar? So do you be like, okay, you go to Codex or whatever, be like, I'm a total beginner, how do I learn playing guitar, or how do you approach this?
Yeah, sometimes I try to not get too distracted building tools for myself for guitar, but I'll give the AI my goals and what I currently know, and it will come up with a great roadmap, give me a very structured plan, and after that I can even ask it, great, would you want to build an app for me that helps me to follow this plan very well structurally? And it will build an app for me that has like a metronome, has timers so that I can switch between scales to legato or whatever. And the app is not great usually, so I have to, that's where I need to intervene, and I need to tell it to build the things the way that I want them to.
That is interesting, because implicitly I've done the same. So when I became team lead for AI advocacy, I was also like, okay, I have effectively, other than like project management skills, I have not a whole lot of manager skills. So I talk to Claude and be like, hey, this is the situation. This is what is important to me. Give me some literature, research, talks, whatever you think would help me level up. And it turned out into a 90-day reading list. There were like a couple books in between where I'm like, okay, I've read this, didn't quite vibe with it for these and that reasons, make adjustments here. But that, I think that is actually a thing that we are, and this is also a little bit of what I meant with workflows earlier, where I think we're now at this phase of like, okay, how do I get like a repeatable process to get to a certain outcome what I want with AI?
Yeah. Okay. And it is, and it is great also in finding patterns from other fields and translating them to your own field, which is awesome. Sometimes I'll be struggling with a problem. I would really want the AI to find a solution for me. But I guess at some points when you're coming up with new ideas, something that hasn't been done before, obviously AI couldn't be that helpful. But imagine like there are often like on an abstract level, different types of research are connected. Like research in math could support research in medicine because you can represent things as graphs or whatever. A person who's trying to do like research and advance in medicine, they can use AI very efficiently to find relevant research that is applicable in their field and advance their field on their own. It's pretty cool.
I think there was recently an experiment, or it might have been just a claim, that either one of the latest model generation or if the next one, something like that, will be able to write the dissertation for a PhD in math.
Nice.
And to some extent, I'm wondering, I didn't look super deep into that, but on some extent I'm wondering like, okay, what does writing a dissertation, because if we're talking about just like the applying existing knowledge and bringing this into a shape that is appropriate for something like this, yes, AI is fantastic at that, probably already, because it's literally a form of pattern matching in that sense. Is it really the conceptual work behind that, coming up with a thesis, making sure that thesis is reflected in reality with a proper proof. That's one of the things where I'm like, if that is true, that would be very interesting, because it would open up the door for, like, as you said, for like research. This would be super interesting. Okay, you haven't read that. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. Even right now, there are a lot of these kind of summary, like very vertical papers that try to just combine existing bodies of knowledge and compare them and find trade-offs. Even for this, I find it to be extremely helpful. If we start inventing new things with AI that haven't existed in any other form in the world, I mean, that will be AGI in a way. And yeah, we'll figure out life after that. I don't know what it'll look like.
Can't wait. I do think, and that is probably one of the things that I'm very interested in that, or very excited about, is that AI does lower the bar for certain things just so much, even if it's just a proof of concept or something. But like, if you said before, like, I know for a fact, like the Bun repository, for instance, has like a bunch of agents automatically research issues and file a pull request for the fix. And if the pull request holds up certain standards, quality checked and stuff, automatically merge it. That is something that I know for a fact a bunch of people, companies, have been interested in, like automating issue research and like troubleshooting bug finds. That is now something that is more accessible. Is it still very, very expensive? So having that little Anthropic money behind that or access to the models is definitely helpful. But that's kind of what I'm interested in. It's like, okay, it's opening the door for new processes, for new patterns, for new ways to automate. To the question before with, can I see engineers taking over more of product manager work? I absolutely can. And I mean, I'm in developer advocacy. It's always been a very cross-functional space. You have done developer advocacy before too, you know that. So in a way, I do see these roles converging a little bit more. But at the same time, I think this is something very exciting because it opens up this discussion of like, okay, how do we develop software again? Like I feel like we had this conversation a couple of times, at least throughout my career, with like the difference between like agile and waterfall in like a software process, then with cloud versus on-prem, that kind of brought up this like, okay, we need to rethink how we do system design. And this is now a little bit again of like a new field where we're like talking process, but then also design to make sure we can utilize this tool properly. That was a very, very long explanation of where I wanted to go with this. Do you see processes already changing within a company like Google, which is like very big? Usually process changes is one of the most difficult things. So things like that move usually pretty slow.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely a lot of things are changing and we're trying to figure out how to be more efficient in these new times. And also to the previous point, even if we don't have AGI and AI is just great in pattern matching, that's still transformational. Like finding security issues is pretty much a pattern matching process and we have to do it by hands. And we might have not had our coffee in the morning, which would prevent us from seeing them, but that AI will be able to pattern match really well. And we can use it
on that pattern matching, I'm also absolutely useless with like any kind of design question. Can I with something like an agent bring up at least like in visually attractive enough demo that I can show that to someone to properly pick it up from there and make like something better out of that? Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a tool we need to utilize. The security, let me actually make a tangent question here real quick about the security thing again. Do you think, I think at this point a couple of weeks ago, Cal.com announced that they're moving a lot of their stuff from open source to private source just to give them more time to handle security issues that are getting addressed. How do you feel about that strategy?
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking it's very similar to before, just the scale at which things are happening, the pace at which things are happening is faster. Previously, if someone cared really about your products, they could find an exploit if it's open source or not. Like they could do that easier by looking at the code. Now it will be faster pace. And like, it depends who finds the exploit faster, the white hacker or black hat
I have some. I think that I don't know how I feel about this, to be super honest, because to some extent, like, it sounds a little bit like security by obfuscation, which is not really a great security pattern.
Yeah.
At the same time, usually the decision for open source or not open source are rather business driven than just the attack surface.
Yeah.
So from that aspect, I'm a little bit wondering, okay, it sounds like there's more to that than just the fear of potential attacks.
And what else was I thinking? Yeah, being not open source also is not a big safety guarantee. They can still
exactly
figure things out. Like, the agent can still try to exploit you in different ways, your production system. But I get the appeal. The fear behind it. Open source feels exposing. I mean, if I sometimes feel a little bit worried, what if someone looks at my project from 2012, in which I didn't use binary search or whatever, I didn't follow about coding practices.
Okay, a completely different question, but do you feel in that sense there's going to be a shift in the, like, in this conversation around imposter syndrome? Because I basically, on what you mentioned, I was also hired by one company earlier on for my RxJS knowledge. So I kind of came in there with, like, the stigma, oh, this is an expert, and Nicholas is so great. And I kind of felt like the pressure of, like, okay, I need to live up to this. Now, with, like, this aspect of, like, okay, being a super deep expert in technologies and stuff is a beneficial skill, but not, like, the highest value contribution. Do you think this conversation is shifting in a sense? Yeah.
Yeah, good question. I'm thinking that why it's a human problem, and I think we'll keep having it. It may create new opportunities for us to have it, yeah. And it will probably shift things a little bit. But I'm imagining if a new generation person comes who doesn't have necessarily as much understanding of the computer science concepts, and they're great in using agentic tools, I see how they could have some imposter syndrome. And I could see also how their colleagues who are not, maybe creates more opportunities for anxiety. Yeah. Probably. That's what I'm usually seeing. The more technology evolves, the higher the anxiety levels get globally too.
That's true. I personally don't think saying, hey, AI generated this code is an excuse, because there's still your name associated with that. A company, if there's, like, a major outage in the software that you wrote, is not going to sue Claude Code, but they're coming at you being like, hey, what happened here?
Yeah.
So, like, this accountability aspect, I think, is not dramatically changing. And from that aspect, I think the associated pressure in terms of, like, imposter syndrome or something is probably not going to address or change dramatically. At the same time, I would not be surprised if this this narrative of, like, hey, this code is purely AI generated, is become more socially acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing is, to the imposter syndrome anxiety, I've been seeing a lot of people putting more pressure on themselves to ship all the time, because they could theoretically do that. They could ship 100, like, 24/7.
Okay. You have to tell me, and I'm not accepting no for an answer. Is that something that a company like Google does on scale?
People shipping 24/7? Or?
Yeah.
Depends on the individual, mostly. There are some people who really get into it, and there are some people who take breaks. But it's easier to not take break now, because previously you'd burn out. You write whatever your maximum for the day is, 500 to 1,000 lines of code, or I don't even remember now. And now you can just one-shot it in 10 minutes.
Okay. And now we're talking about things that I'm super interested in, so I probably have to keep you hostage here for another hour. Do you think this way of working with, like, a bazillion agents in parallel and you're just orchestrating it, etc., is sustainable? And I intentionally use sustainable here because it's the most vague term on, like, describing your personal attitude towards it, but also your team's attitudes, your product's attitude, etc.
Yeah, I kind of think that things are heading that way, and making that scale is a big part of the engineering challenge right now that we have. How do you scale these large agentic systems and set the right guardrails? But that's where I think we will be very, we are already in a way, and we're just making it more complex.
So you can see in the future, just as an example, I'm going to manage a fleet of 10 agents in parallel, and I'm jumping between different features. And at the end of the day, have like 100 pull requests. I think the creator of OpenClaw had like 1,500 commits a day on like peak time. Do you think that is a way of working that we're moving towards in the industry? I think there's a very different way of like between open source and industry in this sense.
Yeah, I think you said it at the beginning also. It depends on the kind of work you're doing, right?
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I said that.
Yeah, for some projects it might be viable. Kind of.
I don't know. I have like a big background in like finance, healthcare, and stuff, and like, or like I also work for like government organization. I can absolutely not envision these kind of organizations working in such a way.
Yeah.
At the same time, at JetBrains, I do see people working this way very successfully. Okay.
Yeah, but it will be very cool for these government organizations to finally not have broken UI, right? That would be great. Thanks to AI.
Yeah.
I've been seeing that's something else that I've been thinking with slides. There is no reason for us to have not good looking slide decks anymore if we're presenting at an event. To
be fair, I was always super salty about slides on events. I think most of the slides are just bad. I should rather not have slides at all than bad slides.
All the slide decks now will be purple using Tailwind styles.
I transitioned my slides to slide.dev a couple of years ago, and I'm now super happy with that decision of like, because like, I, just as a side note, Gemini is still working terrible with Google Slides. you're probably aware. But so having slide.dev, which is effectively just Markdown with some view code in between if you want to, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, you have back to the orchestrating a fleet of agents and having agents run 24/7. I think right now we are a little bit in this AI honeymoon phase where companies are effectively just like, here's this pot of gold, and it's basically virtually unlimited. That is not going to be the case long term. That at some point is going to be this conversation about a return of investment. We're spending X amount of dollars in AI. We expect to see X amount of dollars worth of outcome. And I might be a little bit pessimistic, but I foresee a logarithmic return of investment in terms of AI usage. Just as an example, is there really a benefit if I create 100 pull requests in a day, if effectively my team can just review 10 in a day?
That's where I see it being dependent on the work you're doing. And things are also, I'm anticipating local models becoming more powerful. They'll for sure get better. This would probably change the requirements for our hardwares too. I can see how more and more vendors will start shipping laptops with great GPUs. So great for NVIDIA.
Yeah. They have been on how to run for a couple of years now.
That's something I'm really interested in. If I have a couple of years of sabbatical, that's something I'll be working on.
Okay. Do you use local models yourself in your workflow at some extent, or is it mostly experimenting with Gemini?
No, yeah, a lot of Gemini. And in my spare time, I would, like for my hobby, let's say my side projects, I'll use other models just to see where the rest of the world is.
Yeah. Do you see particularly in the enterprise field, companies moving towards a direction where they potentially train their own models, or maybe something like Cursor did, where it's more like a reinforced learning approach based on some company internals that is then, for privacy but also possibly cost efficiency reason, hosted within like a local network?
Not that much in these circles now. I'm also looking at like Google and wherever I find the resources I'll find online. I see a lot of, I'm reading a lot of papers, so I would see big companies. Yeah, actually, I see often big companies trying to fine tune models for their own use cases because of their proprietary technologies.
Yeah, I think I can see this for like the big scale IT companies like an Intel, an NVIDIA, for instance, I'm not sure how accessible this is going to be to, like, a, I don't know, Bank of America, right?
Yeah, BMW published a paper about it, which was about their proprietary language.
Who?
BMW, the...
Okay. Oh, yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I have one last question, and then I... this was a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for taking your time out of the day to jump on this call with me. What do you... I said it a couple times throughout this. I'm the most excited about workflows. For instance, beginning of the year, I was super excited about the Ralph Loop, which was like the first real workflow with AI that I was like, okay, this is an interesting approach. Do you see any pattern, workflow, process kind of like that, that is utter nonsense with AI?
I'm sure there is plenty. Just there is so much stuff on GitHub right now. It also depends on the perspective. I could be a little more like maybe critical towards some projects that's just my personal criticism towards them. Like, I've never run OpenClaw, for example, and I don't think I'll run it. Just I don't think I'll provide access to all these sensitive data sources that I have, given that, as you said, the creator was pushing 1,000 pull requests today.
OpenClaw was definitely one of the things where I experimented with it, had it like fairly sandboxed, and therefore like the usage of it for me was just basically just be like an automated research in the background, where like every morning I got like a summary of news where I'm like, yeah, this is nice, but it's a lot of work to set it up and maintain it and stuff. I am wondering if this is just like the starting point for like personal agents, which is an interesting aspect. Now, being in a manager, it would be fantastic for me if I could, before my one-on-one, get a summary of like, hey, this is what your team actually did in the last period or something. But you the also... security aspect, though, is very concerning for me, too. I had it very restricted. I never felt... I literally received an email from a colleague and a phone call from another colleague who were using OpenClaw, and I was like, the fuck are you doing there?
I'm thinking also the mistakes that we used to do before, prior to AI, they're just the same. Often they're just scaling. I've been getting more emails from recruiters lately, but like the ones that were not the productive ones, because there are recruiters I'll definitely love to hear from. Just there are a lot of great professionals, but sometimes someone will be like, hey, you're... project Angular C is an incredible project that will be really valuable for our company, and we're interested in hearing from you. And I'm like, well, I deprecated it 7 years ago. Definitely not as valuable as your AI told you it is.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if this personal agent pattern is becoming more prominent. There's a lot of like proper catching up to do to have this in a... Because for some extent, that deterministic aspect is kind of relevant. You don't want to send confidential information to a different email or something like that. Yeah, so I'm wondering how to see how that goes. I was considering experimenting with Hermes for that purpose because I've heard good things. But at the same time, time is limited.
Yeah.
All right.
I've been hearing good things about GDS.
Like, sorry?
GSD, I guess. I've been hearing good things about G as a harness, I guess. It gets shit done. They have a whole pipeline and like specs. I haven't, as you said, time is limited, so I haven't used it myself, but something worth keeping an eye on.
All right. Promise last question, and I'll let you go. Anything you would like the listener of this episode to take away from this conversation that we had?
Yeah. I'd say AI hype is going to have ups and downs, and just try to get less impacted by them and find a good use of AI for yourself and stay consistent.
I love that. Thank you so much for coming on. Again, very much appreciate you. And one thing for people watching it all the way, if you would like to see any particular guests in the next or in a future episode, make a comment or something that I know who you would like to hear about on AI, industry, development, software engineering, all the shebang. Just let me know. Appreciate that. See you in the next time. Bye.